This is Commerce Shenanigans, episode 1007, a conversation with Glenn Greenberg. Welcome to the Commerce Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 1007. I'm your host, Adam Chapman, and this is a conversation with Glenn Greenberg. I've been very lucky to have Glenn on the show a couple times in the past, in episodes, I believe, 912 and 940. He worked at Marvel in the 90s. He works on a lot of different bookazines that we kind of get into during this discussion. He's a good writer, or a great writer, I should say. We talk in particular about a book that Glenn wrote in 1996, which is Spider-Man the Osborn Journal. It's long been one of my favorite one-shots, or just any Spider-Man comic. I've always enjoyed it. It definitely occupies a special place for me. I was, you know, at the time, 12 going on 13, and I was just getting into Amazing Spider-Man on a regular basis. I knew of the Clone Saga. Obviously, it had just ended. I think I picked up Spider-Man 75 on the newsstand, and I started buying Amazing Spider-Man really with the first month post-Revelations. But I had a friend who had bought during the Clone Saga, so I definitely had seen some of it there. I later, you know, a year or two later, definitely spent a lot of time to try and find as much of the Clone Saga stuff. I really enjoyed it. Anyways, Osborn Journal for me was a huge entry point because it was a continuity book. It was all about pulling together all this continuity and explaining the Clone Saga in a more coherent manner and explaining the timeline. And as a young fan, I absolutely loved it. And it was really formative for me just to, again, read a continuity heavy book that wasn't, it really wore its continuity on its sleeve pretty unabashedly. And I loved it. It was just something that's always been pretty important to me as a reader and who I became as a comic book reader and being able to really latch on to spider continuity with a book like this. So I was tremendously lucky that Glenn was able to discuss this book with me. We do talk about a little bit of a lingering mystery that I had been thinking about for years. I will say that mystery that I talked to him about in terms of a book that was solicited, I've now, I think, conclusively, with Glenn's help, kind of figured that out. It was a timing, and the book in question was, I guess, removed from the schedule and then never came out because of who was supposed to write it, which we do talk about. So anyways, I thank Glenn for helping to put to rest something I've wondered about for, you know, over 25 years. Anyways, thanks for listening to me prattle on and on. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and listen to us. I always want to say listen to Stitcher, but it doesn't exist anymore. So don't do that. And make sure you do rate us and review us on iTunes. That is very helpful. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to this intro. Let's get right into the conversation with Glenn Greenberg for the third time. Enjoy. Glenn, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. I just can't believe I'm back, since I thought the last time I was on was going to be the last time I was going to be on.
Yeah, you know, just like a comic book that doesn't stay away forever, the podcast is back.
Yeah, no, I was very excited to hear about that, and I'm very glad to be back. I just didn't think I was going to be doing it. I thought you were 1,000 and done, was my understanding.
I mean, that definitely was the plan. You know, I just realized I missed it, or more than that, I found I would read something, and I'd really want to talk to a creator, and I didn't have the avenue to do that anymore. Right. And I just love talking to creators, and I like, you know, plumbing, you know, their mind on what they were thinking about certain projects, and having more opportunities to talk to people like Mark Waid, and obviously Ron Frenz is always a treat. Although yeah. Ron is funny, because I was texting him once, and I was like, you know, I don't want to bother you. And he's like, we're friends. You can pick up the phone if you want. And I'm like, really? Like, that's okay?
Yeah, well, no, Ron, both Ron and Mark are absolutely wonderful to talk to. I spoke to Mark earlier this year for a project that I was working on, and he was it's already out. I mean, I could talk about it. It was the Superman, the Story of Superman book that I put out earlier this year, and Mark was a big part of that, and we just had a terrific conversation, and Ron is a delight. So yeah, it's you're kind of like Frank Sinatra, you know, old Blue Eyes is back.
That's right.
Yeah.
So speaking of, before we get into, you know, what I originally kind of plied you into to be doing the show for, let's talk about your bookazine, or sorry, now I'm forgetting what they are. Bookazines, right?
Yeah, bookazines.
Okay.
They are, when you go to a Barnes & Noble or a grocery store, supermarket, pharmacy, they're those magazine-sized publications that are in the racks. They're usually devoted to a single topic, especially when a celebrity dies. You know, you'll see now on the stands, they rushed out a Jimmy Buffett bookazine. Mm. And so the ones that I've been doing, I've done about two dozen, a little under two dozen at this point. But the topics that I think apply most to your show, I did one for Time that was devoted solely to Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I did one that was devoted to the Marvel Universe. I did one that was devoted to Stan Lee and his, you know, his co-creations in the Marvel Universe. I've done most recently was Superman, which I think probably maybe the best one that I've done.
Oh, really?
And Superman isn't even necessarily my favorite comic book character. I just think that the job that I did on that one was just really above and beyond. I just thought it turned out great. And I'm working on one now. It's a little too early to say what the topic is, but it's coming along really, really well. And just if you like Superman, I think you're going to like this one. without giving away too much. But Spider-Man was the first one that I thought, like, wow, this really came out well. And I think Superman came out even better.
What was the first one you did?
The first one I did was John Lennon.
Oh, really? That was the first one. I know obviously you've done a bunch that have been Beatles-related. I didn't realize that was the first one.
I've done four that were Beatles-related. I did one for John Lennon. Mm-hmm. I did one for Time magazine about Paul McCartney. I did a Beatles trivia book. And I did my most recent one was going inside the making of the White Album.
Mm. That's cool.
Yeah, it was. It came. I think that's another one that I came. I think it came out really, really well. It's a wide variety. I've written about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I've written Star Wars. I've written about Star Trek. They just keep coming, and they've been a lot of fun.
I have to say, I do enjoy having you on Facebook because you have a lot of, you know, you watch a lot, you consume a lot of content, and often you put out, like, you know, capsule reviews of a lot of it, and I always find it interesting. I don't always agree with you, but I definitely always find it interesting.
Well, that's what makes the world go around. If we all agreed on the same things, it would be a very boring planet that we live on.
Absolutely.
And I get into disagreements with my closest friends about stuff, so it's but that makes for interesting conversation. I'm sure I have friends who actually like the Clone Saga. You know?
I mean, if you count me as a friend, then it would be yes.
Of course. It's you know, I've had a lot of disagreements with people over the last Indiana Jones movie. I've had a lot of disagreements over the Flash movie. So yeah, we can't all agree on the same things, and that's fine.
Going back for a second to when you did your first bookazine, and the fact that it was on John Lennon, like, how did I, and you've probably told me in the past, so I forgive my memory, but, like, how did that one come about to be working on that? And obviously, like, you have a passion for the Beatles, and I'm just curious, like, has that always been, like, a big part of your life, or, like, a big focus that you have, and it was just natural that you would work on a project like that, or how did that come about?
The Beatles have been a big part of my life since I was about 6 or 7 years old. And up until that point, I was a fan of the Monkees. And the Beatles put out, or actually, the Beatles didn't want to put out, but Capitol Records put out an album in 1977 called The Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl. Mm. And that was my first Beatles album. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with them. And after that, the Monkees were history for me. I mean, that was it. I was all in with the Beatles at that point. So we're talking 1977. So I would have been around 7 or 8 years old. And I soaked up everything about them. I read all the major bios. I even read the minor bios. Every article about them. Everything. I did a deep dive into the Beatles. Was just waiting for the day when they got back together. And obviously that thought ended on December 8th, 1980. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I've been entrenched in the Beatles for most of my life. In terms of this book that I did starting with John Lennon, it was by pure serendipity. I have an acquaintance who was the editor and publisher of the book. And for some reason, he did not know I was a Beatles fan. He just called me out of the blue and asked me, would you be interested in writing this?
Oh, wow.
And I jumped at the chance, basically. It was complete serendipity that he happened to think of me. He didn't know I was a Beatles fan, and I just jumped at it. And it was sometimes these things just fall into your lap. It doesn't happen a lot, but sometimes it does. And this was one of those instances. And of course, once I did the John Lennon book, it was only natural to keep me in mind for the Paul McCartney one.
Of course. Once you kind of, I guess, revealed your Beatles freak flag, so to speak, did you realize that this was the book that you were preparing your entire life to write?
No, I mean, it was definitely intimidating because it's one thing to listen to the music. It's one thing to be a fan. It's quite another, and I felt it was a really big responsibility to write about the subject matter for a mass audience. Mm-hmm. You want to do the subject justice. You want to be fair. You want to be objective. You want to be factual. But you also want to tell a story, and you want to make it interesting and focus on the things that you think people will be interested in. So I took it I had stage fright going into it. I probably had stage fright throughout the entire thing. And it was only a couple of years later when I did the McCartney book that I felt a lot more confident about myself because I'd been through it already. Mm-hmm. And I knew how to do it. But the first time, I was probably more nervous than anything else. Mm-hmm. And so that was my sole thought going throughout the whole process was, can I do this justice? Because now it's a matter of putting your money where your mouth is. You can tout yourself as a Beatles expert and a John Lennon expert and all that. Now it comes time to writing about it for a mass audience. You better get it right.
Was it in some ways more intimidating with doing the book about McCartney because he is still alive as opposed to Lennon?
Say by that point I knew the form, not so much the formula, but I knew the format. Mm-hmm. And I knew how to do it. And with McCartney, I came to the table a lot more prepared because, like I said, I'd done John Lennon already.
That's right.
So after I finished the John Lennon book, I said, if ever I get the chance to do a McCartney book, this is what I would do. And I wrote down a whole bunch of notes completely on spec. And so a year and a half later, when the opportunity arose, I said to my editor, it was the same editor, I said, I just happened to have an outline for the McCartney book. Let me share it with you. And he looked at it, and he maybe had like one or two minor adjustments that he suggested. And we took it from there. So yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge with the McCartney book is he has lived twice as long as John has at that point. Paul was turning 80 at that point, so he lived twice as long as John did, so there was so much more material to work with. But all of this stuff falls into place when you're actually doing the work. Hmm. And so as much as there was to work with, and I had to distill everything down, and yeah, there were things that I would have loved to have gotten into but didn't get the chance, but I think I got in all of the major beats in Paul's life and his work.
Yeah. Now, speaking of, like, when you're doing ones about, comic books and other, kind of comic pop culture, that sounds like it would be more, not more naturally in your wheelhouse, but I guess from what I would have known you from, that would have felt more akin to the Glenn Greenberg I knew.
Well, say that I put as much care and love and attention into the non-comic book works as I do the comic book works. Because for me, they all have to be treated with the same level of professionalism. Mm-hmm. Because that's my job as a journalist. Sure, you can have a greater interest in one or the other. And I would, for me, it would be a real challenge to say, what do you like more, comics or the Beatles, or Star Trek, or Star Wars, or any of that? So I love them all, mm-hmm. Almost equally as much. But the trick with the comic book stuff, the comic book related bookazines, is it's a lot easier for me to pick up the phone and call the actual people who worked on the material. It would be very tough for me to pick up the phone and call William Shatner when I'm writing about Star Trek. But when I'm writing about Superman, I can get on the phone with Mark Waid. I can get on the phone with Jim Shooter, which I did. I can get on the phone with Dan Jurgens or Mike Carlin, all of whom I interviewed for the Superman book. For the Spider-Man book, it was just a matter of, you know, getting on the phone with Roger Stern and Tom DeFalco and David Michelinie, John Romita Jr., Howard Mackey, Jerry Conway, all these people that I have access to. So that's the big difference is as much as I'd love to get on the phone with Paul McCartney for the book I was writing about him, it wasn't going to happen.
No. I guess that's a fair point.
Yeah, so with the comic book related stuff, it's a lot easier for me to do exclusive reporting and interviewing. Although with the Star Trek book, I did do an interview with George Takei, so that was pretty cool.
Absolutely. So let's roll back time. We're gonna go back 27 years, if you can believe it. So 1996, I believe, is when you start working on Spider-Man: The Osborn Journal, which is, I have said it many times on this podcast, but it was when I was getting into comics. I was kind of later getting into comics. I was probably 12 or 13 when I really started buying comics on a regular basis, when most people, I guess, stop. So I was kind of falling into it at that time. And so when this came out, which I guess its cover date is February 97, so I guess it would have come out in what, December?
Came out in December of 96.
Okay, so I think I had started buying Amazing Spider-Man on a regular basis 2 or 3 months earlier. So like, fresh off, like, I'm just right in, I'm getting in, I'm, you know, picking up this, I'm picking up 101 Ways to End the Clone Saga, I'm picking up, you know, Hobgoblin Lives, I'm right around this period. And so I had seen the Clone Saga from the outside, because I had a friend who had picked up a lot of the Clone Saga comics. I had, I think at this point, picked up Spider-Man 75, so I saw how it ended. And then I get to read this, you know, this amazing one-shot that kind of lays it all out. So I want to kind of go back and, at what point in the planning process did this come across as something that you would end up writing? Because obviously you were working in the Spider-Man office, so how did you become the writer of the Osborn Journal?
I think at that point I wasn't even working in the Spider-Man office anymore.
Okay.
I think that part's a little fuzzy. I think by the time Ralph Macchio was editing the Spider-Man titles, and he edited the end of the Clone Saga. Mm-hmm. So by the time he took over as editor, I don't think Tom Brevoort and I were really that entrenched in the Spider-Man office anymore. There really wasn't a Spider-Man group anymore, as I recall. But every now and then we would work on an ancillary project, and certainly Hobgoblin Lives was one of them. Mm. So Ralph Macchio and I, you know, were and are dear friends at the time and still to this day. And we would go out to lunch all the time. And what happened was, this would have been in the late summer, maybe, of 96. We were out to lunch, me, Ralph, maybe a couple of other people, and Ralph had mentioned that for December, in December, Marvel used to put out what were called budget busters. Mm. And that was to make budget for the end of the year. So they would put out a lot of, like, you know, one-shots and other, like, special projects just to get them out there, generate some income, and help us make budget for the end of the year. Mm. And Ralph said that they put on the schedule for December of 96 something called Spider-Man: The Goblin Journals. And he was responsible for putting it out. and he had no idea what it is. Nobody told him what it was. And he was telling me about this at lunch. He says, Glenn, I got this project on my schedule now. It's Spider-Man and the Goblin Journals. He goes, I don't know what it is. I have no idea what it's supposed to be. I said, nobody told you? He goes, no, because they just put it on the schedule and I'm supposed to figure out what it's supposed to be. So I said to him, Ralph, here's my thought. I said, remember how I'm sure you remember or at least know about the Tomb of Dracula series that Marvel put out in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, and it was written by Marv Wolfman. He wrote almost every issue of the series. And every now and then he would do a series, he would do one issue that was excerpts from Dracula's journal. And so it would be like these little vignettes, maybe like three or four little mini stories in the issue. And they would be these little incidents that happened in the past told from Dracula's point of view. And so you knew that the stories were skewed because he's the villain and he's going to always put himself in the best possible light. But you'd get a sense of what the events of these stories were and just what an evil being Dracula really was. And so I said, Ralph, I said, what if you did something like what Marv Wolfman did with Tomb of Dracula, with those issues from Dracula's journal, and have it be Norman telling the entire clone saga from his point of view. So you see exactly how he was involved, and you see how from his point of view, the events intersected with what we saw in the books and how he was manipulating things. And we would get, you could get into just how directly he manipulated certain things versus how, he wasn't involved with other things, all in his own words. And Ralph, of course, was a huge Tomb of Dracula fan. He knew exactly what I was talking about. And he said to me, that sounds great. That sounds exactly what we should do, Glenn. You want to write it? and I said, no. I said, I don't think that this is something I should be doing. Because at the time, we had a fairly new editor-in-chief who, once he gained power, he set about tearing down a long-standing Marvel tradition, was that editors could write while they were on staff. And that was a tradition that went back all the way to Stan Lee.
Of course.
And every editor at Marvel who wanted to write while they remained on staff had that option. If they could find an editor who supported them and liked their work and was willing to give them freelance work. Mm-hmm. But this editor-in-chief was starting to undo that policy. And I was afraid that it would put a target on my back if I was, taking on more freelance than I already had at the time. Which at the time I was actually pretty busy doing various things. I was writing Rampaging. Oh no, this was 96, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. So this was before. Oh, that's funny. I ended up doing a lot of work before after this.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah.
I guess that policy. I guess I kind of skated under that policy. But anyway, I was concerned. I was concerned at the time. But I said to Ralph, I said, my suggestion is, why don't you call Kurt Busiek, because he's such a maven when it comes to Marvel history. Mm. And I believe he had recently done Spider-Man Legacy of Evil, which was a one-shot, a painted one-shot that Kurt wrote and Mark Texera painted.
That's right.
And he did that for me. He did that for me and Tom Brevoort. So I suggested Kurt write it because he had all this goblin knowledge from his research, having done Legacy of Evil. And Ralph said, okay, Glenn. I goes, yeah, that's not a bad idea. I'll do that. And I said, if Kurt turns it down, let me know and we'll talk. And my understanding is that Ralph called Kurt and Kurt did turn him down. I believe Kurt felt that he'd already done too many history-related projects between Marvel's Legacy of Evil. I think Kurt wanted to focus on present-day stuff. He wanted to contribute to the Marvel universe in the present day rather than these historical projects, which I completely understand. He didn't want to be pegged as typecast as the history guy,
But so he's so good at it.
I, Well, but I can understand. I can understand where he was coming from. He didn't want to be pigeonholed, and it's very easy to get pigeonholed in the comic book industry. And so Ralph came back to me, and he said Kurt turned them down. I said, okay, under those circumstances, I'll do it. And so that was it. I mean, that's really how it came about. Was I had made the suggestion in terms of the concept, and Ralph offered it to me, and I suggested Kurt, and Kurt turned it down. And at that point, there was no reason for me to turn it down at that point. And so when it came back to me, I took it.
Now, were you involved in the process of, I guess, changing the name to the Osborne Journal from the Goblin Journal?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was my idea.
It definitely sounds better. I mean, and I think it just works. But it's interesting because I was doing, in preparation for this, I was going back through old Marvel Vision magazines just to find the original solicit in that magazine for this book. And I think at the time it was the Osborne Journals. I think it was plural originally when it was in the original listing.
That didn't make any sense to me either because it was just one book that he was writing in. So. I think that was a carryover from when it was called the Goblin Journals, and so I changed it to the Osborne Journal, and I guess whoever was doing the solicits didn't get the memo.
It is interesting because I guess, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, obviously a big part of the Hobgoblin's history was finding the Osborne Journals as well, right? Those versions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this was, since it had been established that Norman had kept journals, this was his current journal. This was his most recent journal.
Absolutely. So it makes a lot of sense. Now, I'm curious, when it was first maybe announced to fans, if they maybe hadn't made that connection yet that it was Osborne related, because obviously in October is when people found out that Osborne was actually back. So I don't know how early they would have seen that solicit at that time.
I have no idea. I don't even think I saw the solicit.
It exists.
I'm glad to know that. I'm glad it got some attention and promotion because I never saw any.
So I actually, before I move on, because it did remind me of something, when I was looking at these old Marvel Vision magazines to look at all these solicits, just to find the one for the Osborne Journal, I came across a solicit for a book. Now I'm going to blank on the exact title. Yeah, as far as I know, it was never published. It never came out. But as a kid, I remember seeing it and being really excited for this. And it was supposed to be the official Marvel timeline. And I'm curious, and I think it was supposed to be written by Mark Gruenwald, but I don't think the chronology works out. Because I think he'd already passed away by that point. Does that sound familiar at all? Because I've never asked anyone about it, but I just recently found that solicit did exist. It wasn't just a fever dream of a 13-year-old. Like, it did exist at some point.
It vaguely sounds familiar, believe it or not. It vaguely sounds familiar. Now, Mark died in the summer of 96.
Okay.
I believe it was August 12th, 1996. And so if this was solicited around the time when he was still alive, and then he died in August, there was no chance that would have continued after he passed.
No.
Nobody else could have taken that on.
Okay, I don't think I'd ever put that together before because again, when I first saw the solicit, I was 12 or 13, didn't think anything of it. Right, I just was excited by it, and I remember for years being like, "Where's this book?"
That's definitely a book that Mark would have excelled on, and he would have absolutely loved to have done it. I vaguely remember that being a project that was in the pipeline and probably under his purview.
Which makes sense. I mean, who else would have been the one to run that, right? You know, after this podcast, I'll double check and find that solicit and I'll confirm that because I'm curious about it. But that makes sense if the timeline works out that unfortunately after he passed away, there's no point in doing that book. That would have been his baby.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And nobody would have done it as well as he would have. Could have done it.
Yeah, I think, I'm trying to think who else would have even been on a short list of someone who could have put that together, maybe Peter Sanderson or something like that, but...
Sure, Peter would have been great with the research. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
For sure. So back to the Osborne Journal. So at what point in the process, and I'm asking you things from 26, 27 years ago, so I understand that it might be in a haze of memory, but I'm curious at how early in the process did Kyle Hotz come on board?
Okay. Okay.
Like, had you already written the script, or like, you know, again, was it Marvel style, or was it pretty detailed script? Because obviously you're conveying a lot of historical stuff, right? So there's, it's heavy lifting for both you and the artist, really. Like, there's so much.
I did do it Marvel style. Yes, I did do it Marvel style. I think, if I remember correctly, I turned the plot in, and then Ralph, you know, well, let's see. I mean, give me a second to just sort of try to recall the sequence of events. I think that I was work. I think I turned in the plot because we did do it Marvel style. I didn't write a full script. I turned in a plot, and I think once I turned in the plot, then Ralph started looking for an artist because he wanted to be able to just send the plot out right away. And to be honest with you, I don't think it took me too long to write the plot.
No, I can't remember if you said it to me or maybe I read it in an interview at some point, but I think I recall that like you basically came up with it on like a subway ride.
It was a bus ride from one end of Brooklyn to another.
That's great.
I had written a timeline for the entire Spider crew to sort of work out. I think it was basically a Norman Osborn timeline.
Oh, really?
because once we decided that Norman was the mastermind behind the Clone Saga, and originally it was going to be Harry, which would have been a lot easier. But once it was decided that Norman was the mastermind, it had to be figured out how this all could have possibly worked. I mean, the guy was dead. So how where was he? What was he doing? What was his activities? Why wasn't he? Why did he stay away for so long? And why is he only making his return now? So I took it upon myself, and this was when I was still at least tangentially part of the Spider group. I took it upon myself to figure it out. So I had written a timeline for Ralph and the Spider-Man writers that took us from the moment Norman supposedly died in Amazing Spider-Man number 122 from 1973 mm-hmm. to 1996, the beginning of the Clone Saga. And so it was all hypothetical. It was all conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
And if they wanted to take it, they could take it. If they didn't want, if they had a better idea, they could do that. Well, Ralph read it and he decided this is the canon. This is absolutely this is the continuity. This was what was going on. Great. Okay. So when it came time to do the Osborn Journal, I just basically took the timeline, and so the whole thing, like I said, the whole thing took me. I can't remember whether it was the timeline or the plot, but I got on a bus from one side of Brooklyn where I was living at the time, and was going to visit my parents. And from the time I got on the bus and started writing, by the time I got to my parents' house, I basically had the framework for. Again, I can't remember now if it was the timeline or the plot. It was one or the other, but I had it, and that was the basis for everything that followed.
Hmm. Now it's interesting now, obviously, because you know this happened again 26, 27 years ago when Norman Osborn was resurrected. So it's been longer since he's been alive than how long was you know that he'd been dead when you guys brought him back.
It was 23 years that he was supposedly dead.
Now, did you have misgivings when you just from you as a bystander, not a bystander, but someone in the office when it was going to be Norman, regardless of how difficult that it might be to explain? Did you think it was a mistake to bring back Norman?
Yes.
Do you still feel that way now?
I have mixed feelings about it now, only because I think some cool things have been done with him since he came back, and I think you know once he came back. My feeling was we have to use him and we have to use him well the best way, you know, because we're trashing one of the pivotal Spider-Man stories of all time.
Mm.
So if we're going to do that, we at least have to make it worthwhile. And the only way to make it worthwhile is to keep Norman alive. because I think the original idea that the editor-in-chief was pushing for was, well, we'll kill Norman again at the end of the Clone Saga and Spider-Man number 75. I said, wait a minute, we're going to bring him back just to kill him again? I said, no, we can't do that. My feeling was, if he's back, let's keep him around and just use him well, because that's the only real way to bring some kind of honor to any of this. But I still feel that Gwen and Norman died in the same storyline, or at least that's the way it should have remained. Mm-hmm. But if Norman is going to come back, use him well. And I think for the most part, he has been used well. I think some stories have used him better than others. Mm-hmm. I think that Dan Slott did a great job. He did a terrific Norman story towards the end of his run, mm-hmm. which when I read it, I said, you know what? This makes it all worthwhile.
Oh, wow.
This was such a, and it was beautifully illustrated too. It was a one part story, and I wish I could remember the issue number, but it was close to the end of Slott's run, and it was, like I said, beautifully illustrated, and it was a great character piece, and I said this makes it, you know, this almost, if not doesn't make it worthwhile, it almost makes it worthwhile. So I'm as opposed as I was to it when it was first broached, I'm at least at peace with it now.
Now, let me ask you a speculation. Do you think if he hadn't been brought back, do you think they still would have used him in the Sam Raimi movies if he hadn't been brought back and still had a presence?
Yeah, because Sam Raimi was a huge Silver Age Spider-Man fan.
That's fair, actually. That makes sense.
I think that us bringing him back certainly brought him to the forefront of Spider-Man at that point. At that point, Norman was the big deal in the Spider-Man books around the time that they actually started making the movie. I think that had it not been the Goblin, had Norman not, let me put it to you this way. If Norman hadn't come back in the comics, mm-hmm. I think it probably would have been more likely that Dr. Octopus or somebody like him would have been the villain in the first movie. Mm-hmm. But I think, I have little doubt that Sam Raimi would have gotten around to Norman at some point, regardless of whether he was alive in the comics or not.
Okay, that's fair. And it does make sense, because you're right. He skews so heavily Silver Age, and those movies are definitely a love letter to that era.
Absolutely. And nobody was a bigger Spider-Man villain in the Silver Age than the Green Goblin.
Absolutely. So let's go back to the Osborn Journal. So you have the plot, then they start finding an artist. So first of all, I mean, Kyle Hotz is brilliant in this book. He does creepy and weird mm-hmm. better than most people. Mm-hmm. And like his first shot of, you know, Norman getting off the table and having all the scarring is really, really, you know, an unsettling in a good way.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And like even the crazed look on Norman's face, like it's just like, oh my God.
Yep. No, Kyle did a fantastic job, and he really got into it. I think he really enjoyed it. I don't want to speak for him, but I think he really enjoyed it. He and I talked throughout the process a few times, and he seemed to be jazzed by what we were doing.
There's definitely a manic energy to the book, which makes sense if it's a character like Norman Osborn, again, narrating things, that it would have that kind of energy. I'm actually we're still working on scheduling. I'm hopefully going to have Kyle on the show soon.
Terrific.
So I would definitely love to, you know, discuss this book with him. One thing, just looking at the credits page, I'm just curious about, how'd you get Mark to do colors? Because I know you guys are friends. He was obviously in the offices, but obviously also did a lot of colors. Did you ask him, or was that from the editor, or where did?
Oh, that would have been Ralph.
Yeah. Okay.
That would have. Well, Mark was doing. We're talking about Mark Bernardo.
Yeah. Sorry, I should have said that. Mark Bernardo.
Mark Bernardo was doing a lot of coloring on various projects for Marvel at the time. So, and he knew Spider-Man like nobody else, because he had been the assistant editor on Spider-Man for a couple of years.
That's right.
And so he knew what colors to put in, no, it just made perfect sense. And he's a good colorist too. I mean, I don't think that coloring was his main focus, because I think given his druthers, he was like me. He wanted to be an editor and wanted to be a writer, and he's a very good writer. Mm-hmm. And I think coloring was something that he did on the side, and he was quite good at it.
Absolutely. Now, I have to at least make mention of excellent lettering by Richard Starkings and Comicraft, because it's a very specific, like, I don't know how to describe it, but the font that is used, or like the lettering style for Norman's Inner Monologue, definitely, first of all, looks like someone's written it. Like, it looks like, you know, someone's penmanship, but also looks, again, like it's channeling a manic energy to it. I don't know if I can put it into words. I hope you understand what I was trying to say.
I know exactly what you're trying to say. I think that my only quibble about it was I wish it was just a little bit more legible. Mm. Because while I'm sure it looked great on the proofs, you know, we were still using, you know, old printing techniques at the time, and so I think that there may have been spots here and there where it wasn't as legible as it could have and should have been. I saw a reprint in one of the trade paperbacks where it was printed on really slick paper, mm-hmm. and the whole thing looked a lot better. But at the time we were limited by the kind of paper that we could use. And so I think that in certain places it may have been hard to read the handwriting that they chose for Norman.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of, I mean, obviously we talked about how you kind of developed the plot and all coming from that original timeline that you'd kind of put together. Were there any specific parts that, I'm not trying to say that you're patting yourself on the back, but like, is there something, obviously you took a puzzle and you figured out a way to make it work. Is there anything about how you made some of those puzzle pieces work that you were particularly proud of?
Yeah, I would say first and foremost, I'm really proud of the fact that I gave a rationale for why, if Norman had been alive this whole time, why didn't he just suit up as the Goblin again and go right after Spider-Man and get revenge once and for all? And the rationale that I had was he saw Harry finally starting to man up. You know, that when Harry was, you know, practicing in the suit and getting used to using the bat glider, the jet flyer, whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. He went back to his warehouse and saw Harry starting to practice because Harry was starting to unravel, and he decided that he was the Green Goblin. And so Norman decided, okay, let me give the kid a chance to really become a man once and for all. Because that was the one thing that Norman always wanted for Harry, was for Harry to just become a man already, stop being a wimp. And get a pair of balls, so to speak. So I decided that was why Norman was willing to fade into the background, but he was going to keep tabs on Harry. Hmm. And he had bigger fish to fry. So he went off to Europe to take care of, you know, whatever interests he had in Europe at the time. I think he was expecting to come back right after Harry ended up being the flop that Norman figured he probably would be, and I think that my rationale, if I remember correctly, because it's been a while since I've read it, normally Norman would have just come right back and taken Spider-Man on again, but he got involved with the Scryers. Mm-hmm. And so that kept him in Europe. He had bigger fish to fry. He now had unanticipated concerns that he didn't have going in, and so that kept him in Europe, because that was his ticket to power, was being involved with the Scryers. And so I was very proud of that. I was proud that because I'll tell you something, my original plan, and this was shot down, my original plan was that there was no way in hell that Norman, had he been alive all this time, mm-hmm. would not have just put the Goblin suit back on, gone after Spider-Man, and tried to kill not only him, but everybody close to him. after this near-death experience. Mm-hmm. So my rationale was, the only reason why Norman wouldn't have done that is if he physically could not have. And so my original idea was that Norman was going to be incapacitated for all those years. He's in a hospital somewhere, hidden away by one of his underlings, and the whole healing factor that I introduced would have been part of that continuity anyway. It was always going to be there, but because he'd been so grievously injured, it would have taken years for he normally, had he been just a regular human, he would have been dead. No ifs, ands, or buts. But because of the goblin formula in his system, he was healing, but not like Wolverine. So he would have been in a bed somewhere, slowly healing and manipulating things from a hospital bed. So all the stuff that he would have been involved with, it still would have been Norman, but it would have been from the confines of a hospital bed with other people doing his bidding, because he physically cannot do it. He's too injured, and he's slowly getting better. And so the rationale would have been, why is he coming back now? Because it's only now that he's physically fit. He's physically able to do it. Okay, and so that was where I was originally going to go, and the editor in chief shot it down because he said, "I don't want Norman to have been conducting things from a hospital bed for all those years. I want an active, physically fit Norman." Hmm. And so that's why the healing factor, healed him so quickly. But that wasn't my original idea. My original idea was I wanted him to be physically incapacitated for all those years, and it's only now that he's regained full strength.
I think I like that more, only because it definitely feels like by making him more physically able, it does make you as a writer have to come up with more hoops to jump through to explain why he doesn't come back. And you did a pretty good job of that, I thought, because again, and I like how each time, like, there's two major times, I guess, where you really come up with the reason why he doesn't come back. One is obviously, when Harry fails, he gets distracted by the Squires, who obviously were part of, power and responsibility that started this whole second clone saga. And then the second with the Hobgoblin emergence, and then him being distracted by Judas Traveler instead, who is again another major player from Power and Responsibility. So I don't know if that was on purpose that you used those two characters to kind of launch this thing kind of brought them back. But I liked how you used them both as distractions that would keep him away, especially Hobgoblin. In some ways, that's almost more of an affront to his ego than even Harry's failure.
Absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly what I did. In fact, again, it's been a while since I read it, but my intention was to drop a hint, because this book predated Hobgoblin Lives by a few months. And I was going to drop a hint that Norman knew who the Hobgoblin really was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I can't remember if it made it into the book. You probably remember better than I do.
I'd have to go back and read it and more intently to see if you actually did have that breadcrumb, because I don't remember it off the top of my head, but now that I'm looking for it, I'll definitely have to give it another reread.
That was definitely my intent. And I don't know if it made it into the final script, but absolutely, you definitely unlocked the secret behind my machinations.
Now, again, what I find fascinating about this book, and again, I like it a lot. I really enjoy it. Always have. But I can imagine that, was there ever any pushback at the time about this book? Because, I mean, it's basically stringing together continuity in a way that's, trying to present a plausible reason for, what Norman was doing. Was there ever any pushback? Not from editorial necessarily, but just from others who thought maybe that this book didn't need to exist, or that it wasn't, was there ever anything that pushed back by it?
Not that I know of.
Good, because it's great.
Well, thank you. No, I never heard any pushback. No. Quite frankly, I think that, while it was in production, nobody even really knew about it. And once it came out, again, I didn't really see a lot of promotion for it, so I don't know how many people actually knew about it at the time, you know, when it came out. I don't remember. I certainly didn't get any, like, letters from fans about it. So I don't if there was pushback, if there were negative reviews, if people had issues with it and didn't feel like it needed to be done, I wasn't aware of any of that. I think it needed – I mean, if I were just a Spider-Man fan at the time instead of somebody who was actually working on the books, I mean, my reaction would have been, what the hell? how is he back? You know, because the explanation that was given in Spider-Man number 75, I don't think that would have been satisfying to any longtime Spider-Man fan.
No, because you're right. It just kind of happens, right? Like, your book definitely provides all the context. And it also explains a lot about the characters that had been, again, in those books at that time that were never really given a lot of depth. Like, we got characters like Gaunt, and you do a lot more, and it's actually much more upsetting because of, you know, your text, because especially the way Kyle draws it, you have, you know, the horrible, you know, the body of Gaunt or Strom, and you have him, like, getting resurrected or, like, kind of shocked back to life, and it's horrifying.
Well, thank you. And as you probably know, Gaunt was supposed to be Harry.
Which would have been pretty cool too.
Yeah, and Gaunt was supposed to be the big villain. There was never going to be any layer above Gaunt. But then when it was decided that Norman had to be the mastermind, we had to add this whole layer above Gaunt. And so that was... it took the story in another direction, good or bad, not up to me to decide. But I have to give Mark Bernardo credit, because it was Mark Bernardo who kind of came to the rescue and suggested that Gaunt be Mendel Strom.
And it's a great reveal. And also, I mean, you do the setup that helps to explain, you know, all the Squire's technology and that it was actually Strom who helped put it together, which, again, is one of those great kind of light bulb moments because, you know, I always felt that Judas Traveler and Squire, they might have looked cool at the beginning, but, like, they didn't feel like Spider-Man villains. Spider-Man villains generally feel a little bit more, you know, down to earth, and they were a lot more cosmic feeling, at least at the beginning. So I did like how, near the end of the Clone Saga, obviously we see Judas Traveler is not what we originally thought he was. And then your stories definitely helped to flesh out, you know, the actual real world application that made the Squires what we thought, you know, what they looked like, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, there was that, and there was also the, you know, the main Spider-Man books never resolved the mystery of the extra Peter Parker clone.
No, the skeleton,
the skeleton in the smokestack. So I had to deal with that as well.
That's right. Yeah, and the multiverse of it all. Right. Like, again, I really liked how you tied everything together because, again, it felt natural. You started to see how the pieces. And so if you read yours and then go back and read, you know, certain segments of the Clone Saga, right, it definitely just start to make more sense. And it starts to feel like it was planned, even though you kind of went back in and fixed it afterwards.
Well, that was the intent, and it's a term that Roger Stern, I got from him. He called it Marvel serendipity. And it just worked out that way. That all the pieces were there for me to just sort of, you know, I think you called it before the puzzle pieces, putting them together, and it was a lot easier than I think it had any right to be. But it also helped that at the time I had pretty encyclopedic knowledge of Spider-Man. I was really just up to speed on not just what was going on in the books at the time, but you know, in the past. Going back all the way to the Lee Ditko stuff. Mark Bernardo, I believe, you know, I think he and I were kind of like on even ground in terms of it was actually funny because when Mark Bernardo suggested Mendel Strom turn out to be gone, all the writers were like, who? So yeah, so Mark and I were pretty well steeped in the history, and so yeah, I was able to, like, just sort of say, okay, what needs to be explained, what are the lingering issues that were not resolved, and how can we do this? And quite frankly, I think the skeleton in the smokestack, it gave a resolution, but it was, it was just so off the cuff and just kind of like thrown out there. And it just goes to show you how unplanned and ill-planned the Clone Saga was, that we threw that mystery out there. Mm-hmm. We introduced it, and we had no idea where it was going to end up. And so the only resolution was like one or two lines in a one-shot that maybe half the Spider-Man audience was even going to read.
No, you're not wrong there. But I mean, at least you've provided a resolution, because it would have been also really easy not to, because again, obviously the books are moving away from any of that stuff. And what we ended up seeing, they kind of stopped ever mentioning the Clone Saga for years. It was pretty much like verboten. Like I shouldn't say right away, because I think after the relaunch of 98 is really when that started, because up until that point, you had a few moments where like Tom DeFalco was writing Amazing Spider-Man. He made mention of it a couple times. Spider-Man had like a hoodie on once when he wasn't dressed as Spider-Man. He was just as Peter. And he was like, this is what Ben used to wear. So you had, scant references here or there, which were kind of cool if you were reading the books. And then
I did a sequel a few months later with the Robot Master, with Mendel Strom.
And
Spider-Man Unlimited. So yeah, I mean, it was quasi verboten.
I would say after 98 is when you stop seeing any references to it, and mm-hmm. it always made me laugh that there was an X-Men storyline, and they had Joseph, the clone of Magneto, but they went to such degrees to not call him clone. And I'm like, it's obviously because of Spider-Man. Like, they're not, they don't want to use that word anymore, because that word's become poisoned. And it's funny to see it now, because obviously, Ben Reilly has been back in various different ways. Kane, like, it's almost funny now, but this is just the way of the world. You have people who grew up on this stuff, and now they're the ones writing this stuff, and they want to write the stuff that they grew up on and that they loved. And so suddenly the Clone Saga isn't a dirty word anymore. And that's why you have all these collections and omnibuses and reprintings, and it's all out there, and people are actually enjoying it, because it was given a bad rap that I always felt it didn't deserve. Yes, maybe it was a bigger thing than it maybe could have originally been. But I mean, it's also, that was the time. People were still buying Spider-Man books. So obviously you're going to want to, hype it up, make it a bigger thing to make people buy more books. Like, it's just capitalism. I don't know what everyone's shocked that, at the end of the day, comics are a business. It's not, we want it to be art, but it's also a business.
Well, you also have to keep in mind that this was coming out at a time when the comic book industry was in free fall, and everything was just sinking like a stone. And the only books that were bucking that trend were the Spider-Man books. And that was on the strength of the Clone Saga and everybody wanting to know what the hell's going to happen next. And it took a lot longer for the Spider-Man books to start to be affected by the downturn in the comic book industry. And yeah, we were pushed to keep it going. It was one of the only success stories of the comic book industry in the mid-90s until it was no longer a success story.
Mm-hmm. And then it gets tarred and feathered, right? Which is not fair.
Well, it was tarred and feathered for two reasons, I think. One is for the audacity of declaring that Ben was the original all along and that Peter was the clone. Okay? Strike one. Strike two was stretching the story out well past its toleration point, or at least the audience's toleration point. And I think that it was padded, and it felt padded, and there were just, it was one event after another, and it was just to prolong the whole thing, and it just kept the series in limbo, where nothing was proceeding, because and there was no resolution, because we were supposed to keep it going for as long as we possibly could, and it was frustrating for us, because we would keep on setting these end points for the Clone Saga, and then we were told, no, you got to push it back, you got to push it back again, and I don't want to, you know, we lost one of our important writers because he just got tired of, you know, when he was told that we had to delay the resolution of the Clone Saga for another 6 months. He just, you know, he left. I don't feel like at this point it's my place to drop his name, but I will tell you that it happened, and he just got frustrated and said, I'm out of here. So he left, and we really could have benefited from him remaining.
From a story perspective, it always felt that, like, obviously, you know, I think the Clone Saga was supposed to end, and then Onslaught happened, and so they had to kind of push it to after Onslaught. But by at that point, when you guys at least knew it is finally going to end, I always felt that the stories were really able to set it up better because then now there is a now they knew that there was an endpoint, and there's more time to kind of properly set it up so that it felt less sudden and more earned at that point, even though obviously it was not the original plan, but at least it gave you a little bit more runway to build stuff up. Like, you have Peter getting ill and then, you know, almost dying, and then that's his powers coming back.
Which was my idea. Yes. I pitched that idea. And for the exact reasons that you're saying is because now we've got 6 months to play with. So I shared my idea with Mark Bernardo. And we grabbed Ralph, we took him out to lunch, and I said, Ralph, let's let the readers think that we're really going to kill Peter off, because we've established that Ben is the, you know, we've got Ben is the original, and he's set up as Spider-Man. Let's let the readers believe that we're really going to kill off Peter and leave Ben as the one and only Spider-Man. And what it really is whatever illness has struck him, it's his powers coming back. And so that was that was my idea, and I will tell you, and I don't feel like I'm speaking out of turn because Ralph doesn't care. Ralph's attitude was, let's use these 6 months to make the readers fall so in love with Ben Reilly that they will be devastated when we kill him off.
I think it worked for a lot of people, to be honest.
I think so, too.
I think people were happy to see the Clone Saga end, but were also sad to see Ben go.
Yeah, yes to both. And I think if Tom DeFalco had his way, and he's talked about this publicly a number of times, so I feel comfortable talking about it. I think if Tom had his way, Ben would have been spun off as the Scarlet Spider or whatever identity, you know, we came up with for him, and Peter would have continued as Spider-Man.
Yeah, I mean, they did a lot of that in the early 90s, right? Because you had War Machine get his own book. You had Thunderstrike get his own book. It was all about, you had U.S. Agent, I think, had miniseries. Yep. I don't know if he had an ongoing. But yeah, you had these kind of spin-off characters. So yeah, very easy to see that would have been the plan, because that's what had worked.
It had worked at the time. I was in the camp that felt that doing stuff like that diluted the original characters. You know, I didn't think there was enough of a difference between Thunderstrike and Thor, and so I gravitated towards Thor. Although I love the team of Ron Frenz and Tom DeFalco, so, you know, Thunderstrike was a beautiful looking book. You know, I just wish they were still doing Thor. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
War Machine. I thought it was cool that, you know, that Rhodey had his own thing going on. I think that there was a little bit more variance between him and Iron Man. I thought that kind of worked. But Spider-Man is so special. He's such a special character. And he is a loner. And there shouldn't be anybody else like him in the Marvel Universe. So I was fine with Ben dying. I felt it was a necessary evil. I liked Ben a lot. I think that J.M. DeMatteis did fantastic work with him.
For sure.
But I felt that for the betterment of Spider-Man, Ben had to go.
Now, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of the specialness of Spider-Man, because obviously with, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, we've had Spider-Verses, we've had Spider-Variants all over the place.
Yeah.
And obviously that's very different now. And just even in the core Marvel Universe, there's multiple Spider-themed characters in the Spider family, if you will. Like, how do you feel like that just on the abstract? Do you think it does dilute Spider-Man too much because it's not just Peter being special?
Well, I'm of two minds. One is, I still feel like there's it ruins the uniqueness of the character.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way from a creative standpoint, but personally, I'll be honest with you, I don't care anymore. I'm too far removed from any of it, and you know, I've got my own life to live. And I don't get paid for thinking about or worrying about this stuff anymore.
True.
So I really don't care. I hope that doesn't sound, as harsh as it may. but that's just how I feel. I don't feel so emotionally attached to any of this anymore. And in some ways, it's kind of like an ex-girlfriend where You hear all the bad decisions that she's making since she broke up with you or since you broke up with her, and you just kind of shake your head and you go, that's too bad, but you don't agonize over it.
Yeah, that's fair.
And that's how I feel.
You know, it's funny. A lot of creators have said the same type of thing. That like when they're done with the book, they're not following it anymore. Like there's no interest. Like why would you want to watch what someone else is doing to your girlfriend? So I have heard that many times.
Well, I never considered any of the titles that I worked on. I never considered them my girlfriends, so to speak. So I can still read Spider-Man if it's good. Mm. I'm reading one of the more recent runs of Spider-Man right now, and I'm finding that it's not very good.
Mm.
But I also read the Dan Slott run, and I liked quite a bit of it.
Yeah.
I thought Dan did some really, and I really liked a lot of Brand New Day. I hated most of what Straczynski did.
Mm.
Probably I hated all of what Straczynski. I can't think of anything I liked about what Straczynski did. But I liked some of quite a bit of the Brand New Day stuff, and I liked a bit of the Slott stuff. And there's so I can still read Spider-Man, but I'm talking about as a whole with some of the creative decisions that are being made. It's just sort of like I just kind of shrug and say, well, it's not my problem anymore.
So let's change gears for a second. So in and around when you have, and I think it's the same month actually, or maybe a month earlier when the Osborne Journal comes out, we have Spider-Man 101 Ways to End the Clone Saga, which is written by Mark Bernardo. You do show up as a character. What was it like seeing yourself as a character in this, kind of fun, I hope it was fun, but like as a reader, it was fun to read. But obviously it was sending up a very tense situation that did exist, but taking and poking fun at it. What was it like, one, to read it, and two, did you talk with Mark about it before he actually wrote it?
Absolutely, I talked to Mark. I talked to Mark before, during, and after. I wish he'd gone further.
Oh yeah.
I wish we could have pulled the veil apart even more and get into more of the craziness. But it would have made some people look bad.
Was in some ways, I guess to go back to your earlier point about, kind of these budget busters, I could guess this would have been cover dated January. So I guess obviously this would have been kind of pushed out at the end of the year. Would this have kind of fit into that mold, that category of like a quick one shot that could be developed?
Yeah. If it was a January cover date, then that meant it came out probably in October, November.
Mm hmm. So that makes sense then. It would be because, it's funny. Like, I had both these books when they came out, but I didn't have the greater context to truly appreciate and understand it till I was older and had read more of these books and understand more of kind of what was going on behind the scenes. But yeah, it's a very fun and engaging book, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. It's and a lot of it really was verbatim what was going on, taken from the memos that we're all sending around trying to get us out of that thing, and comments that were made, and the silliness, and the few, the relatively rare, fun, happy, go lucky moments. But no, Mark did a great job. I don't know if I could have done that book.
No,
I don't know. I think I might have been too emotionally close to it to do it justice. I think Ralph's instincts were good to put Mark on that and me on the Osborne Journal.
Hmm. I did, I mean, in that book, I mean, there's a lot of great gags, obviously. I mean, some of them are more longer moments in that one shot, but then some of them are gags like using the dead flown to attract flies and swat them and that kind of stuff is very funny.
Yeah, Mark was good. Yeah, that was good stuff. He was good. I wish the likenesses were a little bit closer, but you know, the artist who drew it, I don't think he ever came to the office and took pictures of us. Oh. So I don't know what he was using for reference. I would have liked the likenesses to have been a little bit closer, because I think there are parts where maybe Mark and I look a little too much like each other, or you know, or maybe Ralph. I mean, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but I just remember I was like, I wish the likenesses had been a little bit closer, and that there was a little bit more variance, so you could really just look at each of the characters and get a good sense of who's who.
There definitely were a couple spots where you look like Bob Harris.
Yeah, that's
which I don't think was intentional.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Any final thoughts about the Osborne Journal? Like as I said, like I appreciate the work you put into it. I've said it many times. I'm a huge fan of it. It had a huge impact on me when I was a young reader because I loved continuity. Again, I was just kind of getting engaged into this world. So you have this one shot that lays out all this history and puts us all together in a really easy to read format. And like, I just devoured that stuff. And then later, I mean, obviously you worked on Hobgoblin Lives. And in that book, you had like at the very end, you had those pages that referenced all the material, all the different books and like all the different books that were referenced on each page. And again, I love that stuff too, because it just, it whetted that appetite for understanding this world that I was really diving into. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate both those projects, because it had such a huge impact on a very young, someone who's a nascent reader, really starting to jump into everything Spider-Man at that time. And it really helped me do that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. With the case of Hobgoblin Lives and those text, those references, that's all Roger.
Oh, was it?
Roger did all of that. Oh yeah. I mean, I was along for the ride. I mean, I was the hands-on editor, and I read every single Hobgoblin story, reread every Hobgoblin story to prepare for when Roger's plot started coming in. But Roger, that was all Roger putting together those reference pages. He did a fantastic job on that. And then, and also don't forget, Roger and I co-wrote Goblins at the Gate.
Of course.
Which was a sequel to Hobgoblin Lives. And, I guess a sort of sequel to the Clone Saga, in that, you know, it was Norman Osborn versus, the original Hobgoblin. So it would all float into each other.
For sure. And that was so much fun because, I mean, for so many years, these characters could never be on the same page together, and then and now they can be at that point. Yeah. And that, I mean, obviously they've shared, you know, screen time in other stories, and a couple of stories have actually referenced yours. But yeah, there's just something about that first time getting to see them together. And I always appreciated how you really had Roderick Kingsley underestimate Norman Osborn, and just that shot of Norman Osborn, like, I'm Norman Osborn, like, don't F with me, like, yeah, you know, like, and Roderick just being like, how'd you do this so fast? Like, he just had no idea who he was dealing with.
Well, also, it wasn't only that, but also the fact that, you know, Roderick Kingsley, which we really tried to convey in that story, is possibly his greatest weakness in that story is he's not crazy. Mm-hmm. And Norman is. That's the difference. And so that was the whole thing when Roger created the Hobgoblin, is he wanted a new Green Goblin, but he didn't want him to be crazy. And so that was the difference. We really tried to convey that in that particular story, is with all that power and all that influence and all that ability, plus he's nuts. So yeah, Roderick is going to, you know, be a little bit intimidated by that. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Well, and I think what's so much more fun about that too is that, you know, Roderick thinks that's a benefit to him, that he's not crazy. Like he's better because he's not hobbled by insanity. He's read these journals. He knows who he's dealing with, or at least he thinks he does. But it's interesting because that's really what makes him not as strong in some ways as Norman, because Norman has no filter. He's just crazy.
Right. And then the thing was with Norman out of the picture for all those years that he was so-called dead, that did work to Roderick's benefit. But now that, you know, Norman's back, yeah, that's the tipping point between the two of them. Yeah. And
Daddy's home and you've been messing with his clothes.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. That's a great way of putting it.
All right, well, Glenn, thank you so much for your time. Again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it and the willingness to talk about this book because, again, it was tremendously influential for me. So, again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for all the work you put into it, and I really enjoyed it.
That's my final thought is knowing that it played such an important part for you and means so much to you. That's all I could ask for, and I'm very gratified to that, and I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you brought the show back because it's always a pleasure to hear you and Ron friends, sharing thoughts and memories and so forth. And I'll come back anytime. Sure. You keep the show going. You want me back? I hope if you're a Star Trek fan, I would love to come back and talk about my time working on Star Trek.
Absolutely, I would, because I am a Star Trek fan, and that's actually one of the things I'm always interested in watching on your Facebook, because we consume a lot of the same content. Obviously, you come at it at a different angle at times, but I'm very curious about it, so I'd happen to have you back and talk about Star Trek.
Well, if you ever read my limited series, Untold Voyages, that I did for Marvel, that is probably my most favorite project that I did while I was at Marvel. If it's in the top two, I can tell you that much. So if you've read it, great. If not, give it a read, and I can come back and we could talk about it.
That sounds great. Yeah, I think it would be a reread because I think I did read it at one point, but I don't know when it was. It wasn't when it was happening. It was definitely later on.
Okay, well, fair enough.
All right. Well, thank you again so much, and you have a great evening. And I can't wait to have you back at some point in the future.
My pleasure. Great talking to you.